Can you tell me your name and when you were born and where you were born?
Oh, I'm Barbara Kawakami. My Japanese name was Fusako until I became an American citizen. That's when my husband gave me the name Barbara. Until then, I was Fusako Oyama, born in Kumamoto, Japan, on August 24, 1921. And it just happened that I'm one among nine siblings to be born in Japan, because after the big plantation sugar strike that struck all the plantations on Oahu, a year after the 1920 strike, my father decided that he wanted to pull up his roots from Hawaii and go back to Japan, because his older brother had passed away and there had a lot of rich rice land in Kumamoto. And so my father returned with my, two brothers and two sisters above me. And at that time, my mother happened to be pregnant with me. And that's the reason why I'm the only one who was born in Japan. And so after I was born, 3 months later, my father decided that after all, there's no place like Hawaii to bring up children, to raise and educate his children. And so also the reason that I think he decided to come home was he went back quite wealthy. He went home with a lot of gold and all that, I understand, and the relatives and neighbors kept on borrowing the money, and he felt that he'll run out of money if he stays there too long. And I think that was another reason I found out that he decided to come home. And so 3 months after I was born in Kumamoto in August, on December 29th, they arrived in Hawaii. And from what my mother told me during my grown-up years, that's a rough time. The ocean is very rough during the winter weather. And so I cried so much during the night, and I kept all the passengers awake that my father almost threw me overboard.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it's so funny, because whenever I didn't listen or do my chores, my mother threatened me, say, "Oh, you're lucky, that because of her that, she had saved my father from throwing me overboard, But anyway, that's a funny story. So since then, after they returned to Hawaii, until then, before then, I understood that my father, when I did the research, he did come here in 1890 with his first family. His first wife was Une, and they had three children. And after finishing his contract in Kekaha Plantation, he did return to Japan. And then his first wife passed away, and he came back here. And then I think later he met my mother, and they got married. So
Can you hold on a second?
Mm-hmm.
So when you say that he finished up his contract,
mm-hmm.
This is before the 1900 Organic Act. And so it was contract labor where he was bound to work for the plantation
for a set
number of years.
Yes.
So can you explain why he decided to take on the contract and go to Hawaii, and what was involved with the contract? What was he committed to?
Oh, you mean
to?
The second time?
No, the first time.
The first time, I don't know, because that was long before I was born or anything.
You don't know the history?
No. All I knew is my relatives in Japan told me the story. And until then, my father was educated in the temple school. So in the village, he was supposed to be one of the most, well-educated people. That's 1890. So he worked in the village office as a clerk. And so when he came to Hawaii, I noticed that he even served as a camp police in Ewa Plantation, which is very unusual for a Japanese man. So the lot of things, I found out these things when I started my research, and I started going through the plantation, towns, and talking to people who were retired. That's how I found out about my own parents, too. Until then, everything was so vague, because my father died when I was 7, and my mother never told us anything. All she said was, oh, your father was a drunkard, no good, you know, only drink sake all the time. But it wasn't so, you know. When I went to Japan for the first time in 1972, I think that's when I met your Aunt Alma, you know. But really, that's the first time it was a really awakening for me in finding out the rich family history that existed on my father's side. And so all I know about my father is he was here in 1890. I thought it was 1902 when I first started studying. And then Gaelic Kubota, you know, Alexander Baldwin Museum, I knew him from the very beginning when I started my research. And one day he was at the archives looking through that microfilm. He found out my father's information that he arrived in 1890. So from then on, that gave me a lot of, you know, lead to doing the research. And then I found out that when he returned was 1902, and he brought his children with him, you know. He's probably a half-brother.
He returned where? To Japan or to Hawaii?
No, to Hawaii. Yeah.
Can you say that? Well, hold on a second. My understanding is that it was very hard to save money working on the plantation. So how was it that he was able to afford to return to Japan?
I think, you know, in Kekaha, I was trying to find out. When I went to Kauai for a lecture, you know, with a picture bride, I did go to Kekaha, but they had no records of that period. Everything was brought to Kunia. And so, and then now I found out that it's over at Hamilton, and I did try to trace it. So far, they couldn't find the information, what my father was doing in Kekaha. So I don't know whether he was a laborer or doing clerical work like he did in Waipahu. So that I have no idea. And so I think after the three-year contract, I think he took his family back. And then I think when his wife passed away, you know, he decided to return to Hawaii again. So he brought his children. So one daughter died here, and one older brother lived here. And you know, we were very close, you know, with the older brother and family. And that's all I know because I was so young at that time. But after he returned the second time in 1902, he worked at, we settled in Waipahu Camp 1, which is, in those days, the camps were segregated. And we lived in Japanese camp, you know, they call Camp 1, Japanese camp, next to the Filipino camp, and they had Okinawan camp, Korean camp, which had only about three Korean families living up on the hill. And so very segregated, you know. And so when we, my father worked in a huge warehouse, which is used to be right above the plantation village, right above the hill. There was a huge warehouse. And that's where my father worked as a clerk, and he took charge of entire inventory. And I heard this from an office worker, Mr. Kawamoto, who moved to Mililani right above here after he retired from Owashiga Company. He was the one, because he worked in the office, he knew about my father. Until then, I didn't know. And so through him, I found out that he told me, oh, your father was a very intelligent man, you know. Imagine, say, he worked for Mr. Smith, he was the manager of the huge warehouse, and they kept all the inventory, you know, for the hospital supplies, to the plumbing supplies, the carpenter shop. Everything was kept in that huge warehouse. And my father was such an able assistant, so according to Mr. Kawamoto, Mr. Smith had complete trust in my father. I don't know where he picked up his English. He could read, you know, and he spoke a little English, I think. Maybe in Japan, he worked as a clerk, so, you know, it's near Nagasaki. Kumamoto is near Nagasaki, so he might have picked up some English, you know, before he came. And so it was interesting, and he worked there until, and prior to that, I think, I found out through another, Mrs. Kumasaka told me that when I interviewed her, she was a picture bride. She told me that from what she remembered, my father early on had worked as a camp police at Eva Plantation. And so, see, things that I didn't know, I really found out through, my clothing, research on clothing, I met so many people. And so when my father worked for the warehouse already, I was old enough to remember. And every day, we lived right in the hub of plantation life. The sugar mill was right across, you know, the railroad. And the railroad ran right below our home. So every morning I would get up early with my father. You know, he worked at the warehouse, so he didn't go to work. He didn't have to go to work early like the field workers. But he got up early anyway, and I used to get up with him. And we had that outhouse in those days. You remember plantation? The outhouse was quite a distance from the home. And so every morning I would get up with my father about 4 o'clock, and I would sit on the back porch and wait for him, you know. And then, so one morning when he took so long, when I waited and waited, that's when I got interested in the stars. I knew what the dipper was. And my father said, oh, in Kumamoto, you know, they saw the same kind of dipper. And I remember writing stories about it. And I thought that morning he was unusually, taking a long time. So I went to check, and there he was sprawled on the outhouse, you know. He had collapsed there. And see, I was barely, not even 7 yet, you know. And so I rushed to, wake my mother. My mother was pregnant with the youngest brother, you know, the 9th child. And so she was still sleeping. And so she ran to the outhouse, you know, tried to move him, but too heavy. So she ran out to the back road, and all the workmen, you know, already about 5, they're, you know, walking briskly down the back, you know, dirt road to catch the early morning train. So she got hold of a couple of my father's friends, and Mr. Takahashi, I remember, was a good friend, and he was the first one who came to help my father, you know, because those days nobody has cars. This is 1928, July, and only the plantation manager and the assistant manager and the camp police, there were only the 3 people who owned cars in Waipahu, and the taxi driver, maybe, you know, 1 or 2 taxi drivers, and that was all. And so they had to rush and, you know, get the camp police to help take my father to the plantation hospital. And so I still remember vividly. I was very young, but funny, you know, that vision always stayed with me. And my father had a brain hemorrhage, I understand. Yeah. But until then, you know, every day we enjoyed watching my father, especially I used to go and wait for him, you know, by the doorway of that his office, you know, where he worked. He had a desk, and I still remember, you know, I would always poke my head in and wait for him to finish work, and we'd come back together. And so,
You were saying, so he came back with your mother and you and the entire family in 1902? No,
he met my mother here. The first wife, you know, he was married in Japan to his first wife, and he had 3 children.
And they came over in 1890.
Kekaha Plantation, yeah.
And then they went back in...
They went back. Second re-entry...
They went back in 1893?
I think so. That, I don't have a record, but...
And then she passed away.
Yeah, in 1902, you know, he re-entered with his children. I think... that is still not clear. We were talking about it yesterday too. I think one, the twin girls, one died, so I think he came back with, you know, one son, and he may have left the twin girl. That was long before I was born, so, and my mother never talked about it.
But so. Then, so he met your mother here, and then they returned in 1921 to Japan?
That was... yeah, when he met my mother here, they got married about 1914. I think the record is somewhere around, you know, 1913, 14. And then in 1920, there was the major plantation strike. And then after that, a year after that, 1921, they went to Japan. So for my mother, she's from Fukushima, Northern Prefecture, which is very unusual in those days because people from the same prefecture got married. And everybody said, oh, how come, you know, your mother is Fukushima King and my father is Kumamoto King? Because it was love marriage. And it was funny how, you know, people talk about that period, the restrictive immigration period, they had that only a certain people, unless you had somebody sponsoring you. You know the Asian Exclusion Act? Until 1924, I think it was effective. It started, I think they started working on it about, it was supposed to, you know, conclude at 1920, but kind of dragged on, you know. And in Hawaii, the picture brides and those who had the sponsored, they call it yobiyose, you know, if the parents were here, they could send for their kids from Japan. So during the 1908 to 1924 period, which is called the restrictive immigration period, that's when my mother, see, my father was here. They must have met before then somewhere. I found out, you know, in Eva or something. They met each other, and I think my mother wanted to come back, I think, to marry my father. And so this I found out, you know, during all the research. And so to enter Hawaii, she needed someone to sponsor her, but her relatives had all returned to Japan. My mother's grandparents were here also, but they had returned to Japan, you know, by 1915. And so she needed a sponsor, but she came here as a temporary spouse of her younger sister's fiancé. So it's weird, you know, how in the olden days, I found out that a lot of people did that when I, you know, started my research. In order to enter Hawaii, you either came as a temporary spouse, they call it karifufu, means temporary spouse, and during the voyage, they have to share the same room and everything, and then when they came here, you know, they applied for divorce and each went their own way. So she, my mother's case, she came as a temporary spouse with a younger sister's fiancé, and then she applied for divorce, and then she had to wait a year to marry my father. And that I became very clear when I started talking to other people too. And so that's how, yeah, it's...
I'm confused. So they would allow a couple to come if they were married.
Yes.
But they wouldn't allow a single person to come.
Unless they're professional doctors, missionaries, you know, ministers.
And then also in your mother's case, you're saying she was already in Hawaii, and then she went back to Japan, and then wanted to come back.
Right. Looks like she was married before, you know. And then I think she returned to Japan. I think she, too, got divorced, and she returned to Japan. And
well, I'm just so surprised because I thought that it was very difficult to raise enough money to go back to Japan.
I know. I don't know how she... All this is new. In fact, my brother wouldn't want me to, I think, talk about this, you know, really. Because nobody in my family knows this. Only because I'm the historian in the family, I did extensive research.
Okay, well, so let's talk about your father again. Do you know anything about his experience in the 1920 strike? Was he involved or not involved because he wasn't really a field laborer? And then why did he decide to go back? Like, did he go back because of the strike or?
I think it was very unhappy situation for him because he was doing clerical work. Actually, he didn't have to go on strike. You know, he was getting a salary. So we were... you know, well off during that period when my father was living. And so because he didn't strike, I think some people hated that, you know. They used to call him names and all that. And I found out that towards the end, he had to side with the strikers, you know, which he didn't have to because he already was getting a good salary. But I think someone told me that he had an unhappy experience because he didn't really participate in the strike like the ordinary laborer did. And maybe, I don't know, that's the reason why maybe he returned to Japan. But, you know, he died in 1928, so, you know, I wouldn't know. And my mother never said. Only through my research when I started interviewing people, I think only a couple of people mentioned that, oh, your father had a rough time because he didn't have to strike, but, you know, because the ordinary people were suffering. You know, they didn't have enough to get by, and it was very rough, you know. So I think he must have been involved, you know, caught in a very unsatisfactory situation. I think that's the reason why he returned to Japan. I wish I could find out myself, you know. Even my cousins in Japan didn't know. But they thought he went back wealthy. He bought home a lot of gold pieces, you know. And, of course, there were four above me. And like when my cousin took me for a walk around the village, we passed through some beautiful mansion. And my cousin said, oh, those people borrowed a lot of money from your father. But she said, your father owned people, five people, and he still had the IOU on rice paper. I have an example here. That one is for about 250, but some were about 5,000, and I don't know, couldn't be American money, you know, but some were American money value worth $300 to 250, according to, you know, the American money at the time. And so my cousin told me that the reason my father decided to return was he was running out of money, and he felt that the children missed Hawaii because they were already, you know, much older than I was. And so they missed Hawaii, and that's what made him decide to come back. Yeah.
And so even though he was a clerical worker in Waipahu, he lived amongst all the Japanese field laborers?
Oh, that camp we had, the house was pretty nice, you know. He, next door there was a luna, you know, where Maurice,
Can you describe how the housing was situated in the Waipahu?
Yeah, in that area, in Camp 1, I think, of course, they were a mixed group, you know, carpenter workers and those who worked in the carpenter shop, I think, and the railroad men. And there was a corner, in the corner in Camp 1, there were a whole bunch of Filipino bachelors. And it's strange that when I think about it, they were the only Filipinos right there in the midst of Japanese people, because they had a special Filipino camp, you know, Spanish camp and all that. But the reason they were put there was because my next door neighbor was a supervisor for the railroad gang. Very nice people, well-to-do, and the son was able to go to McKinley High School those days, and he worked in the office, you know, the only son. And so we lived among, and the next door, Mr. Sugimoto, he was also a luna for the railroad gang. So, you know, people in that area, I think, like my father was a clerk for the warehouse. So, you know, wasn't too bad. You know, we had fairly nice, I wouldn't say a real mansion, but at least was a comfortable house. So I think Camp 1 consisted of, I think, the lower people. It was more for maybe convenience. My father worked at the warehouse, so, you know, the house right near the warehouse. And then right behind us were the bachelor, the longhouse for the Filipino bachelors. And they used the outhouse right behind our bathhouse, you know. So that was strange. But then that's how when my mother became a widow, when my father suddenly died in 1928, you know, when he collapsed at the outhouse, And then until then, our life was pretty comfortable. My mother didn't have to work. But here, in the very pregnant condition, she couldn't work in the fields like other women did in those days. And so she thought of working as a domestic help for the Caucasian families in those days. That was the norm, you know. Many Japanese women and widows and even Japanese girls, as soon as they graduated 8th grade, they were sent to work at Holly Homes as a domestic. But for my mother, in her pregnant condition, the only thing she could think of was, while taking care of her own children, she took in laundry from the Filipino bachelors who lived right in that corner. So, of course, the money was so, you know, cheap, you know, only for one person, the laundry, charging about $250 per month, you know, to do all the dirty laundry. And she had to get up at 4:30 in the morning, start scrubbing and pounding that all the red dirt, you know, and then carrying the wet clothing outside and putting it into a large can and, you know, boiling it over, you know, an open fire. And she would even, you know, chop the kiawe wood herself, you know, in her condition, And my brother sometimes helped. And one thing, you know, I'm glad my brother told me about it. My second brother, who was in 442, he found out that one wise thing my mother did as a plantation widow, they had $15 a month, you know, when the husband's spouse died. And so with my mother expecting her ninth child, a man who was, he was a Wataluna, we call it, you know, irrigation. He was a supervisor, and he felt sorry for my mother, and he had prestige because he had a high position, you know, being a supervisor. He went to see the manager, and he said, you know, how can Mrs. Oyama, you know, expecting a ninth child, get along on only $15 a month? There was no life insurance, and it's so sad, you know, that, you know, with only laundry, you know, it'll be too difficult. And so the manager gave my mother a choice of either give her $1,000 to take, you know, to take care of all the immediate expenses for the funeral and, you know, other, you know, urgent things. Or he increased from $15 to $25 a month. So he told my mother that until your son, the baby that she's carrying, until he gets a social security age, they'll give her the $25 a month, or you take the $1,000. And I think my mother was very intelligent. With only a third grade education in the village in Fukushima, she was very smart for her age, because even Tanamoshi, you know, when she ran Tanamoshi, she figured she could divide, you know, do multiplication, everything in her head. Addition was nothing to her, you know, she could just add. Somehow I wish I took her brains, but, you know, she was so smart. And so she chose that to have every month $25. And she did the wisest thing, because with the laundry and somehow we grew our own vegetables. My brothers belong to the future, you know, Future Farmers of America. Oh, we grew beautiful vegetables. We had avocado, papaya tree, guava tree, everything that we wanted. We never starved, even if we could never afford candies or anything. Everything we wanted was, you know, in the yard. And so somehow we survived, and the vegetables that were grown at home. And so my mother, she lived to be 92. The last few years, I think at 78, she had a massive stroke. And so after that, she recovered. But the fourth time, when she had another massive stroke, she became completely paralyzed and bedridden. She lost her speech, and she was in the hospital. We took turns taking care of her, but it got too hard after she became completely paralyzed. And so the plantation put her in an intensive care unit at the Wahiawa Hospital. They still have the green building, you know, it's an annex to the Wahiawa Hospital. And she was lucky. She was one of the last ones that before the plantation or sugar company was dissolved, you know, until then they took care of the spouses and, you know, whoever were widowed, and they helped to pay for, you know, whatever. And from that social security, the money that came to my mother, the $25 a month, and plus I think my mother had some other, I don't know how she had some other income, but the plantation, until she died in 92, they never stopped that the pension money.
Well, hold on. I thought that how they were going to pay the $25 a month until her unborn son
reached social security age. So that was, I think, what, 18? I'm not sure what they meant by it. And that son, that's the only one living today, you know. Yeah, but that was really remarkable, because if my second brother, who was an accountant, you know, lucky, he found out all these things later too.
Oh, wait, so. And then another question is, even though your father had passed away, she still got to stay in the plantation home?
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Oh, okay. That is because my older brother...
Can you start out, because, you know, none of my questions are going to be in the tape.
Mm-hmm.
So can you start out by explaining the plantation home and how...
Yes. After my father died in July 12, 1928, My mother was only 39. My father was 63 years old. There's quite an age difference. And so having her nine child, it was very difficult. And my oldest brother, who was only, I think he was about 12 years old, 11 or 12 when my father died. And so he became the oldest son. He had to help support the family. So, and of course, my mother probably survived on that $25 a month plus that she supplemented her income by taking in laundry for the plantation bachelors who lived in the neighborhood. But then I think my oldest brother really sacrificed because day after he graduated from eighth grade, which is 12 years old, my cousin, who was a supervisor for the Kompang camp, you know what Kompang camp is? A group of men, there's a leader, and he gets a group of men to work under him, maybe about 14 or 15, depending on the amount, you know, to irrigate, to grow sugarcane on acres of land. And so until the sugarcane is harvested, they have a contract for so many years, and you make a lump sum of, you know, $500 or so. And so my oldest brother lived, worked for my cousin, and I think he earned that $500, you know, within the 3 years' time. But as a young boy, he was soaked in, you know, irrigation, so he soaked in water up to his, you know, what do you call it, abdomen? So, you know, it was very hard. Later on, he had a lot of stomach trouble. He died at 55. But at that time, every weekend, my mother, the day he left for was about a year later after my father died. So it was hard when my cousin, he had a Model T Ford. A few people had cars, but because he lived in an isolated camp, that was Camp 19 where he lived, about 5 miles away, you know, so he needed a car. When he came to pick up my older brother, I still remember my mother had wrapped his work clothing, just two changes of work clothing, you know, ahina pants and, you know, a jacket, and only one Sunday best, which was a khaki pants and a shirt made of Indian head fabric. That's all he had wrapped in the rice bag, you know, furushiki, a bleach rice bag. And that's all he left home with, nothing as luggage or anything, you know. And so I still remember the time when he got into my cousin's Model T. You know, he had to crank the car, you know, to start it. And here we all cried, we bawled, you know, and we cried over the picket fence because it was so sad because here father gone and my older sister was whisked away. And, you know, now my brother at, you know, 12, was taken away. So we, even my brother cried, you know, when he sat in the car. And then every weekend, my mother, no matter how busy she was with laundry, every Saturday, all of us, you know, we would walk up. The pipeline is still there. They call it that, you know, the water that fed all the irrigation. If you go up to Royal Kunia, you can see the black pipeline, you know, that leads up to that hill. That's where my mother and us young kids, my mother would prepare bento, lunch for my brother, and bring his change, you know, for the week. And we all hiked from Camp 1 where you can see the sugar mill, the old sugar mill part of it, with the smokestack still there. From there, barefooted, we didn't even own shoes, you know, all barefooted. We walked up that, you know, the pipeline, we followed the pipeline, and 5 miles up to Camp 19, all surrounded by sugarcane and the red dirt. And every Saturday we did that. And so when we went there, it was an isolated camp, you know, really must have been lonely for my brother who was so young. And he worked among all the, you know, older people. And so it was hard. And then they had those lot of ditches, you know, because they irrigated all the sugarcane fields in that area. So we learned to swim, you know, in the ditch. And of course they had a lot of the pigeon peas, you know, the peas that you see at Plantation Village. We used to have those all over, you know. It looks like the small you know, the green peas, similar to that. They call it pigeon peas. Also, I have a name for it, the
I'm sorry, but I don't, can you explain how it was that your mom got to stay in the home because of?
Oh, because my brothers worked on the plantation. See, my older brother, this plantation, Kompang Camp, is a plantation. I belong to Oil Sugar Company, and my cousin is the leader of that camp, and he leases the land or something, you know.
But so it was like sharecropping?
Yeah, sharecropping. It's a group of people get together, and they have a designated person to lead, supervise them, and my cousin was the one who was the leader of the group, you know. The Kompang means partnership. You form a partnership. And then someone has to supervise the workers. And so it's part of Oil Sugar Company. And also my second brother was working for, you know, plantation. Someone has to work on the plantation. Otherwise, they'll be evicted. Mm. For my mother to earn that pension money too, if she left the plantation, probably she may not have, you know, the pension money. And because my brother worked for my cousin who, you know, work for Wolf Sugar under that, you know, the lease land contract, you know. And so, and then my second brother also worked for the plantation soon after graduating from eighth grade. He worked for, you know, Wolf Sugar Company as a painter.
So because of the financial loss from your father's passing, sounds like all the children had to work as soon as they graduated from
Yes, you have to. Someone, like my husband's family too, his father died when my husband was 13. Mm. And so someone has, he had to quit school and work for the plantation. Otherwise, all of them have to move out.
So let's stay focused on your family. I wanted to hear about your sister. Can you describe what happened after your sister graduated?
Okay. After she graduated, day after she graduated from eighth grade.
Can you say after my
sister? Oh, after my older sister, Yayoi, she was 12 years old when she graduated eighth grade. And all of a sudden she disappeared. And I was so young. I was, you know, not even seven or, you know, eight. And so I wondered what happened to her, but I was too young to really think seriously. But she just disappeared. You know, someone, a man came to pick her up in a car, and we didn't see her for, you know, quite some time. And later on, when I started my research, I asked her what happened then. And that's when she told me, you know, several years ago, that a man came and took her to a pineapple camp, you know, where all the pineapple field workers, they stayed at the boarding house where she worked as sort of a maid, you know, household, helping with household chores. And so she had to get up at 3:30 and start making a breakfast for the bachelors, and also, you know, stuff to make their bento in the double-decker tin cans, you know, and doing laundry rest of the day and also babysitting the children. So for my sister, it was very rough, but we didn't even know. We weren't even aware. We were so young.
Well, so. But you were saying that your mom would go and visit your whole family.
My brother.
Would go and visit your brother. How come you couldn't go?
She never did. And my sister, so, you know, nobody had cars. No buses, you know, this is really primitive period. Nobody had cars. If you want to go anywhere, we had to walk everywhere, you know. And so nobody had cars, so my sister couldn't even come home except once a month when she got paid. I don't know how much, I think it was very cheap pay, you know, $15 or $20 a month for all the work. And just to give the money to my mother, the boss brought her home, and she gave all to my mother, the $15 or $20 she earned. It's sad when you think about it. The story came out in her, you know, the funeral service. During the eulogy, you know, the children somehow got together and got that information.
Well, it also sounds like your brother made the decision to go and work for the cousin.
No, he didn't. My mother decided all that. We had no choice. Yeah, my mother probably without even telling my older brother, I think, you know, she was the one who made the decision to, you know, send the oldest son and, you know, talked over because that's her nephew, right? My cousin is her older sister's son. And so she had decided all that. So my brother was even unaware that he was going to an isolated camp to work. I mean, that's the way things were when we grew up. We had no choice, you know. And on weekends, I remember that when, you know, my brother, you know, my sister was already away, but my older brother, until he was sent away, every morning we would get up at crack of dawn, you know, Saturdays, weekends, when we didn't have English school. We would get the burlap bags from the plantation warehouse, and we would hike about 3 miles to where, you the Pearl Harbor, there was a place called Scow, S-C-O-W. It's right in the backyard of Pearl Harbor. We used to walk barefooted from the mill camp where the smokestack is, you know, from there to that Scow, right in the backyard of Pearl Harbor. Imagine, barefooted. We filled up the burlap bag with all the mesquite beans, you know. We call it kiawe beans. At that time, they had a lot of kiawe trees. There were still a lot of Hawaiian people living in that area at that time. And so we'll fill up the bag, burlap bag, with kiawe beans. And here, we're so small. The oldest one, my brother was only about, what, 12? And next one, we were like stepladder, you know, 12 and then 11 and all that. Some were 2 years apart. And up to me, you know, and my younger brother, five of us, older ones, dragged the heavy, you know, bag full of mesquite beans, you know, kiawe beans, across the road, the dirt road, barefooted, and across the railroad track, and bring it to Camp 1. And the five bags, there was an Okinawan man who came to buy Mr. Miyashiro. He kept horses, and he used that as horse feed. So he would pay 10 cents per bag for the kiawe beans that we worked so hard, you know, and that was big money, because for five bags, he paid us 50 cents, all that we gave my mother. And that was big money for us, because we never had any spending money. And so my mother would praise us, oh, you're good children, you know. We don't have father, but she says she's thankful that, you know, we're such a good children. And so with that 10 cents per bag now, we used to go to buy bread at the Mariasu store right below the hill. It's right near the where the plantation village is now. There used to be Mariasu store and another store. We would go early in the morning to buy bread. Bread was only 5 cents per loaf at that time. Imagine, today you have to pay about a dollar something. But, and so it went a long ways, the 50 cents, you know. And so, and then during crabbing season, we would hike so many miles to Hawaii, you know. It's in the outskirts of Waipahu, Waikele. Today they named the city Waikele here, but in those days, Waikele was way out in the outskirts of Waipahu, Hawaii, where all the camp kids used to go crabbing, oyster digging, and oh, really large clams. Yeah, and that was a lot of fun, and we had Hawley crabs and Kaneka crabs, they call it, you know. And of course, Samoan crabs, we used to go to the Pearl Harbor where that Scow, you know, is. They had a bridge that we could take those huge Samoan crabs. But mostly went to Hawaii, Waikele area. We walked through the rice paddies with the Chinese people, had rice paddies right below where the plantation village is now. That was all rice paddies during our growing up days. And so that was our playground. We would trek through the rice paddy, and the Chinese people, we used to call them Pakesang, you know, honor them by calling them Sang. We put the S-A-N, honorific, because my mother let us call them not Pake, you know, like being kind of derogatory. So we call them, oh, Pakesang. They would shoot at us, you know, those shotguns, and they're the scarecrows, because, you know, they used to get so angry, we would trek through the rice fields, you know. And so, yeah, all the way to Hawaii. And that's how I think a lot of our food, we had lots of crab during season and oysters for the picking, you know. Imagine, we used to take half a bag full, so heavy. And so during that season, I think my mother saved a lot. The neighbor woman, I think, probably saved a lot of money. And so those were the kind of fun that we had. For us, we had no toys. I mean, they couldn't afford to buy toys. Everything was handmade. When we went crabbing, we would pick up those wood, unusual woods, and my brother would you know, they would all make some kind of toys with whatever, you know, the dry twigs and dry.
What kind of toys would they make?
Oh, all kinds of animal toys, you know, and kites and some. They had some beautiful driftwood that they used to make all kinds of, you know, toys with the wood, you know, and we would also. A rainy season, it rains so much, and where the plantation mill is now, and the irrigation ditch that ran alongside the railroad track where every morning they pick up the workmen, over there used to get so flooded, it formed a lake. And my brothers would make rafts, you know, in school, English school, when we studied, read about Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, they carved and made their own raft, you know, for rainy days. And out of all the, you know, driftwood and everything that picked up. And we would just float on the raft, you know, a rainy day. But see, everything, because we couldn't afford material things, I think we learned to be very creative. We learned to make our own wooden, you know, slippers, guitar, instead of buying from the store. And I think my brothers were pretty creative, you know. And I learned to do a lot, like Cupid dolls, you know, was 5 cents per. You don't see, I have one sample.
What is a Cupid doll?
It's made of sort of a plastic. And that's the only thing we used to buy at the Cresto was 5 cents per a Cupid doll. I have it here. And all the neighbor kids, because I loved to sew from a young age without learning, all the kids used to gather in my front veranda, and I would make dolls for them. They would stand in line, you know, and they would wait. Each one would wait, you know, with the little scraps their mothers gave them. I would fashion dresses for all the Cupid dolls. And Japanese, you know, those wedding dolls, they call it, you know, on a stick. Used to be like on a chopstick, you know, the Japanese bridal dolls. You buy it for 5 cents a piece at the plantation store or at the mom and pop store. And beautiful Japanese dolls, you know, and it's only on sticks, so you have to put the kimono on. And I don't know, just naturally it came to me because I think I loved sewing. And I used to make all the kimonos and the obis, you know, just tie it. And so all the, you know, kids used to gather in our front veranda, and that was the only fun time we had.
You were describing earlier how you would hang out on the veranda and sing and make music. Uh-huh. Can you describe that again?
Okay. For us, because there were no TVs or radios during that our growing up period, from, I think, 1929, this, I'll be talking about 1929, 30s, and every evening, after we finish our chores, and after dinner, we would gather on the front veranda. Plantation always had the spacious veranda, and we would all sit around, and neighborhood kids would all gather at the front veranda, and then even in the dusk, you know, we kept on talking stories. That was a favorite time. We would talk about the days happening. My brothers got up early and worked in the fields too. So there were a lot of stories to talk about. And so we didn't realize, you know, dusk was settling. Everything's so quiet after the plantation mill closed down. And my brother, my oldest brother, who was so good with the harmonica, it was a cheap harmonica he bought from the plantation store for only 15 cents. But I am telling you, he played such beautiful music, you know. Old Black Joe, Old Kentucky Home. We had tears in our eyes when he played that. You know the melancholy sound that comes out of harmonica, listening to it in the dark, you know. And, oh, it was just so beautiful. And he even played some romantic songs like, you know, that Moonlight on the River Colorado and Red Sails in the Sunset. He didn't know the meaning probably because he was so young. We didn't know how romantic it was, you know, but somehow we enjoyed the music. And when he played 5 Foot Two, Eyes So Blue, at that time, Charleston was a craze. And funny, my oldest sister was still at home at the time. By then she was working as a housemaid, a domestic for the Kern's family. He was a supervisor for the plantation. And my older sister, by then she had gotten away from the working at the boarding house. She was working at the Kern's family. And so she probably observed them, you know, when they had parties that they danced the Charleston. And my sister was very tall. She was taller than any of us, about 5'5". And she had long, skinny legs. She used to hate it when people called her Moyashi, you know, because Moyashi, you know, bean sprout is long, skinny, right? And she was so, you know, hurt when people called her Moyashi legs, but I used to envy her skinny legs, you know? And she, whenever my brother played 5'2", eyes so blue, oh, she was so quiet, and yet she would just get up and start doing the Charleston. And we enjoyed it. So yesterday, the memorial service, my daughter read it for me because I wrote out everything the way it was. And everybody enjoyed that part. Even her children, her grandchildren were there. They didn't know that her grandma was so quiet that she would dance the Charleston. And everybody wondered. Of course, writing it, I thought too, people wondered how come a Japanese girl of 14, she was 14 at the time, working as a maid. And how come a girl, a Japanese girl from a poor family, you know, learned a Charleston? And so because she worked for the Howley family, and also the next door people were kind of wealthy because they were supervisors, you know, the father and the young couple, the husband worked at the plantation office. He was a graduate of McKinley High School. Very rare for a Nisei, a second generation, to be able to afford a high school education. And during that period, all of us, after eighth grade, we were just sent off to work immediately. And so they had parties all the time, social parties. They danced the Charleston. That was the flapper era, you know. They wore those fancy, you know, dresses with the bias cut, you know, skirts and all that. And so my sister was asked to help them. And so I think that's how she learned to do the Charleston.
And can you... You were talking about how you learned to sew when you were very young. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about, were there ways that you made clothes in order to save money? Or did you buy clothes at the store? Or did you make the clothes? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, at the time, there weren't any ready-made shops unless in town. I mean, Caucasian people, maybe wealthy people in town may have gone. But in those days, we never did have ready-made. Not that I can remember. Even plantation store didn't have ready-made dresses. I doubt it. So I think by observing, it's strange. Even my mother and the neighborhood women were, you know, curious that here, maybe I saw my older sister. She took sewing lessons. I don't know whether I learned by observing, but somehow I knew I would rip off some of my old dresses and make copies from that. Or somehow I think I just caught on. Like bone dancing too, once a year during Obon. Even my mother never tied those fancy obi. We call it butterfly obi. And somehow I learned to tie that, you know. And so all the neighborhood kids during a bone dancing period, early in the morning we would go to Waiawa to pick up ginger, you know, to make lace to wear that night for the dancing. Silly, isn't it? You know, hiking about 5 miles to Waiawa early in the morning and then making lace, you know, we're so tired. But then Obon time that night, I would dress the neighborhood girls because the mothers didn't know how to tie the fancy butterfly obi. And so they used to come and line up on the front porch, and I used to tie the butterfly obi for them, you know. And so they said, oh, how come I learned how to, you know, I was very young at that time, I think 12 or 13. But somehow I learned it just, I don't know how I did. Even my mother never tied it.
But was it only the Japanese folks who went to Obon dance? Because you were saying there were Filipino bachelors who lived behind you. Did the whole community come, or was it only
Japanese? No, at that time it was strictly Japanese. Today at Mililani, you see all the multi, you know, ethnic groups dancing, you know, participating in shorts and all that, you know, a happy coat. But at that time, was strictly only people, the members in the temple. So the Soto Mission Temple was only about 3 blocks from where I lived. So, you know, it was very close. And of course, they would make the yagura and all that, you know, the little miniature house that they played the drum and everything. But strictly Japanese and mostly members, there's Soto Mission, temple people would only dance. And the Honganji, we call it Higashi, you know, a temple on the other side, they didn't dance, participate in our church. Today, it's different. People from all over come, especially Milani, you know, it's different. It's middle of a mixed, you know, multi-ethnic community. So things have really changed. But at that time, like, yeah, I think it was strictly Japanese. And also, I'd like to talk about my eighth, you know, grammar school. After we graduated, we all had to, like my older brother, older sister, all had to immediately work from the very next day. No vacation, nothing, you know. Immediately, my mother had decided all that. We didn't know what was going on, but everything was just planned. And for me, when I graduated eighth grade, we had a wonderful teacher, Miss Shizue Kawamoto. She was an English teacher. We had 8 classes in those days, you know, eighth grade, you know, from A to F, I think. And so, she wanted some, you know, children to continue to McKinley High School. We didn't have high school in Waipahu then. And so she was so kind, very conscientious about the poor immigrant children who did well but couldn't go to school. And so she even found a couple, they were both teachers, and they were willing to help me go to McKinley High School, you know, to pay for my not tuition because it's a public school, pay for, you know, expenses for the books and whatever expenses, you know, incurred for education. And as long as in exchange, I would do light household chores for them. And so I was so happy when Miss Kawamoto called me one day and told me. So I ran home and told my mother. And my mother said, "Oh, you stupid, you know, how can you think that you have 4 siblings below you that you have to help support. So, you know, you can't even think about yourself." So funny, just, I completely took that out of my mind. I never thought I could go beyond eighth grade. So that was fine. All of us during those days, we had no choice. You know, everything was just planned for us. And so we just accepted this as part of our life. Because growing up without a father, you know, we just listened to my mother. We never talked back to our parents or to teachers. Even at Japanese school, you know, we never talked back. And so after that, I went to sewing school in the village, you know, plantation camp. A sewing school which was reasonable enough for my mother to afford to pay. And so from the very next day, I started sewing at age 13. I started learning formal sewing, and after 10 months, I got my certificate, and then I went to Honolulu to Kister's Tailoring College for 6 months, and I got my instructor's certificate so I could teach sewing. And so for me, sewing became my lifelong long profession. Since age 13, for 38 years, I did dressmaking. Aside from 1 year, my mother decided that I should work as a domestic to train for marriage. You know, Japanese mothers always thought about training their daughters. Now that I was trained in sewing, she felt that I should work as a domestic to learn American cooking and learning to keep house. And so I worked for this family. He was a supervisor on the plantation. Imagine being depression years, I think it was 1938. He graduated from Harvard, came back, no job, so he worked on the plantation. I don't want to mention the name. It was very sad when I think about it now, you know. Harvard graduate working on the plantation as a Luna, you know. And so his wife came from a very well-to-do family. Father was one of the big 5 for the big companies there. And so I was so young, 1938, 2 years after I graduated, so 14, 15 years old, $20 a month. I reported to work at 7 in the morning, prepared the breakfast, lunch, dinner. 8 o'clock I finished, you know, after the dinner was served and clean up and everything. And then I ran home. In between, I think there was about an hour to go home, you know, for a little rest. But it was long hours of work. And on weekends, often, because, of course, meantime, the boss's wife, you know, she had a baby, so I took care of the baby while, you know, keeping cleaning the four-bedroom house, doing the entire laundry, and babysitting on weekends. She belonged to a very socialite family, and so they were invited to town often, you know, and so I babysat, no extra money, $20 straight, you know, for all their work. And then on weekends, and sometimes when their parents, they would have cocktail parties for 500 people. I saw the Dillinghams, the cooks all there in the beautiful home in Manoa. That's the first time I ever saw a Hawley home, you know, and so beautiful. And going from a plantation house, it was like magic, you know. Going through all the rooms and mirrors in the, you know, window, and on the upper story for those 500 people who came to the cocktail party, there are a couple of orchestras, you know, on the both ends of the lanai. And here the chauffeur came to pick me up early in the morning. I think it was about 8 or I don't know what time, early in the morning, with the limousine to pick me up. And there all day, as soon as I went, they had a head maid over there who worked there for $30 a month, full-time, 7 days a week, only Sunday she had afternoon off, $30 a month, live-in. And so they had a laundry woman and a second maid. And so four of us and the chauffeur, we prepared all the hors d'oeuvres, canapés, all day long for the people, 500 people were coming for the cocktail party. And so was, and then I still remember how terrible it was, the discrimination. I think that's when I realized that I was an agent, you know, working, you know, a plantation person. I wasn't aware yet, because with only an 8th grade education, you don't realize how miserable your status is, you know, until you're put into a situation like that, that really makes you aware for the first time. I really realized at that time how different life was, you know, for the ordinary immigrant families and for the Caucasian people who really lived in, you know, on high status. Because when we were preparing, okay, in the morning, the delivery man from Diamond Bakery, they delivered to the homes, you know, the breads, fresh from the oven, you know. They didn't have to go to the market because they were wealthy. The man delivered so many loaves for that party. And so he was there only a few minutes. I don't think more than 10 minutes. And the first maid, the living maid, sad because she herself sacrificed for her family. Her father died, so she started working from the 5th grade. She quit school and started working as a maid to support her family. Excuse me.
Can you say that again, to support her family?
Yeah. She quit at the 5th grade level to support her family because her father died. And so she worked as a living maid for only, she started at 25, and at that time she worked 7 days a week with only Sunday afternoon off for $30 a month. And when the delivery man came in through the back door, screen door, that's the only time she see another human being, probably, you know, because she's, you know, shut in for 7 days a week, except for the chauffeur and laundry woman. That's all the social life she had. And so when the bakery man delivered, was a Japanese man, I knew him. He was a Waipahu boy, you know, I recognized him. But anyway, she was talking just friendly, like, not long conversation. But I think it was barely 10 minutes when the boss's wife came down. She was having a fitting with all the pins on her dresses. She came down from upstairs, and she said, "Look, I time you. You've been here for 10 minutes now, and I'm paying my maid to do her work, and I don't want you to bother her. I'm going to call your boss and have you fired." With that, he just flew out the screen door, and we were so shocked. That was my first introduction to what it was to be an Oriental, you know. I still wasn't aware until I went to college and started studying all the, you know, in sociology and all that. But that was my first introduction, I think, to the world outside, you know, what it's like, the discrimination and all that. And so we were shocked, and the poor fellow, he just flew out because he didn't want to be fired, right? It's, you know, depression years. And so I felt so sorry for the maid, Hatsumi. For her, that's the only social contact outside, you know. And so it's hard, even when I work for the daughter on the plantation, when I'm, you know, washing the front concrete, you know, walk. One day my girlfriend happened to pass by. We were just talking casually, just for a short while. And then her daughter has the same approach. Because she came from a wealthy family, I don't know, you know. She came right out and told my friend, look, I'm paying Fusako to do my work. I don't want you ever to come and talk to her while she's working here. You visit her when she has time off during the afternoon, you know, an hour at home, and you go and visit her during that time. So, you know, like mother and daughter, I guess they had the same, you know, feeling about, you know, maybe status and, you know, discrimination. I don't know. But anyway, going back to that mother's place, you know, that cocktail party. Okay, that was the incident early morning. We were kind of gloomy. Of course, we were busy preparing all those fancy sandwiches and, you know, canapés and all that. Came lunch hour now. Hatsumi, the maid, knew that we weren't getting paid from the mother, right? She's using her daughter's maid to do that, all that work, and the housekeeper and all that. So lunch hour, she prepared the cream tuna for us. I never tasted cream tuna. Plantation family never tasted cream tuna. And so we were having lunch, and then that lady came down again, and she asked Hatsumi, how many cans of tuna did you open? And so I think I forgot the exact number. Either three. There was a chauffeur, the washing woman, the second maid, so altogether five of us, I think. And so she must have opened, I think, three cans of tuna, you know. And so we're right in the midst of eating. We got choked. We couldn't eat lunch. You know, there's the first taste of cream tuna, but we couldn't eat after that. And then she also baked angel cake, the chiffon cake. She was a wonderful baker, and she had the cake on top of the shelf. And when the boss's wife saw that, she said, oh, Hatsumi, who is that cake for? And she said, oh, because, you know, they're working so hard, so, you know, I baked it for them. And she just like that. And she just went upstairs. But after that, we couldn't eat. And then even Hatsumi cut the cake for us for dessert, you know. It was so delicious, but it was different. Somehow, you know, that stigma, you know, stayed with us, that we shouldn't eat. You know, it was like we're robbing or something, because the boss's wife didn't want her to, you know, actually, I think she was angry that she had baked the cake for us, but we didn't get one penny beyond that. Okay, that was fine. Now came dinner time, but cocktail started at 5, I think, you know, 5:30 or 5, I forgot. Okay. I brought my silk kimono and obi, and the boss told me, oh, I should change into my kimono to start serving without dinner, anything, nothing. We didn't eat anything, all of us. I had to dress in my silk kimono. I tied my obi. And then, you know, the canapés and hors d'oeuvres, all fancy stuff, we couldn't even taste. We were afraid. After that incident, we couldn't even grab one, you know, olives and all that. All that, we sat on a silver chair, which is so heavy, heavy. The silver trays were so heavy, real huge ones, true silver tray. And so we had to carry that up and down, all night upstairs in my kimono, and to serve all the 500 people on the lanai. And how many times I wanted to take one, I was starving. You know, since morning we worked so hard, and we couldn't eat anything. But then my mother taught me, you know, honesty. So I thought, gee, even if I swipe one and put into my mouth, probably the boss wouldn't even know. But because, you know, we learn Confucian ethics in Japanese school, and my parents taught me, you know, taught all of us to be honest, especially growing up without a father. My mother was so strict, you know. Once I even picked a nickel on the roadside, coming back from Japanese school. And my mother let me return it to school the next day. She said, oh, you know, there are people maybe much more poorer than us that need the money badly. So you return it. So I had to return it. And so growing up in that environment, you know, that my mother had emphasized Confucian ethics so much. And I could have sneaked one. My stomach was growling, you know. And yet, I didn't even pick one sandwich. We worked until 1 o'clock. I worked until 1 o'clock. The other maids were dismissed because they were cleaning women and, you know, washerwomen. But I had to serve until 1 o'clock, until the last of the, you know, people, guests left. They were, that's when I also got introduced to the beautiful cocktail gowns that they wore. Yeah, it was a really... I enjoyed that part where all the gorgeous gowns and, you know, earrings, jewelry that we never saw, you know. That's when I think I had passion for, I think, fashion design too. But anyway, after 1 o'clock, when the last of the guests left, and so I thought they were going to serve us, at least let us have some kind of snack, but they didn't. And so my boss and... her husband, yeah, both of them, they had a Chinese maid. Their Chinese maid also helped too that night. So we went, you know, to the boss's mother's house on Nuanu. Yeah, she wasn't as affluent as the, you know, the other one. So when we went there, the Chinese maid, Aling, prepared scrambled eggs and sausages for them and made some, I think, coffee. And they all ate. They didn't even invite me or gave me any, even a little portion. And poor me, I was starving, working hard all day. And lunch, we couldn't even finish the cream tuna. Until I came back, they brought me back about 2:30 a.m. Imagine. But that's the way it was, you know. And the mother, as wealthy as they were, never gave me. Today, you talk about tips, right? Not one penny or anything. And so, you know, that was sad. After I started going to university at age 53, so many things, you know, I became so aware of what life was like on the plantation. Things that we weren't aware of because we weren't exposed to the outside world. So you can imagine when in sociology, anthropology, and other courses that I started taking, and when they said, write about your, you know, life experience, your childhood experience, I couldn't wait to go to Hamilton to write. I thought, gosh, I've got so many wonderful stories to write, you know. I couldn't wait. So when I went to Hamilton, sat in the carrel, held the pen in my hand, you know, the tears just started flowing. I couldn't write. I started sobbing quietly in the carrel. Here the young students are studying next to me, and they would be oblivious to what I'm thinking, right? I'm an older student. But all the past that I never thought about my past until then, until I went to college and started writing all those papers, you know? And oh, just, I couldn't write. During the hour period, I thought I could write a wonderful essay, but I couldn't write. Just tears flowed. And so I tried not to cry loud because of the students, you know. So it took me 3 days to really begin to start writing, you know. And of course I got good grades because the teachers thought my stories were so unusual. Because I had already lived life, you know, what the younger student could never experience, you know. I had gone through all those, you know, experience. And so I did write wonderful papers, and but when I think about how, you know, growing up in a segregated places, and of course the camps too. Like often in lectures, I talk about the pyramid. The plantation manager lived on the top of the hill in a beautiful mansion with yard men, maintenance people, and couple of maids to take care of, someone to cook, someone to do house cleaning. And it was like a ladder, a really true pyramid. The higher ranked people, the Holy people who worked in the office, the supervisors, they lived right below the manager's home. And then by rank, the homes were all, they had not as elaborate as the manager's home. And then the Japanese people who had a better position status on the plantation, they lived right below the Holy families. And so I guess we weren't too bad off. We lived in a semi kind of mixed kind of, there were a few supervisors. And I think because my father worked as a clerk for the, a huge warehouse, I think our house wasn't that elegant like the others, but that's the way it was. You knew your position on the plantation.
Where did the laborers fit in the pyramid?
Oh, yes. It's really like, a letter, that even the outhouses, my friends and I were talking one day at the reunion.
When you wipe your nose, you need to stop talking so that I can get what you're saying clearly, okay?
Okay, yeah. So when friends get together, even the outhouses, we were laughing about it. I never thought about it. See, if you're upper class Japanese, supervisor, maybe you had running water in the outhouse. But the ones who had a low status, the ordinary laborers, I didn't know, they didn't have any running water. See, it was that bad. It really showed your social status, on the plantation. You knew your place. Japanese say, ba, it's a position in life. You really knew your position in life. So for me, I'm glad in a way that I experienced all that, going through the hardships first. If I had a good life and like Miss Kawamoto wanted me to go to McKinley, and if I had gone on to maybe McKinley in those days was like going to the university because, it was very hard to go to high school in those days. So I would have probably found a better position. I would have met different kind of people, and I would have forgotten about my plantation roots. And so, in a way, for me, my life is kind of backwards, but turned backwards. I had to earn a living first from a very young age, but I wouldn't have had all this rich experience to talk about. And the clothing, it was funny that I'm the only person who did research on plantation clothing, and no one had ever done that before or after.
I'm going to run out of tape. Mm-hmm. So do you want to take a break and then
okay, sure.
I'll switch.
I should tell you about, going back to...